So the earlier we start, the earlier Christmas, we can depart for Christmas. So thank you that you kind of showed up on this eve of Christmas Eve, before, no, not Eve, morning before and so on. So let's go ahead. So where have we stopped last time? So we looked at interprocedural analysis. So that was some kind of interprocedural optimization, which was constant propagation. And that was insofar crucial as typically any meaningful program uses procedures, and we need a way to deal with it. And now that kind of completes the analysis of, if you like, the high-level features of the language. We would like now to proceed to a second part where optimization is required, namely not when it comes to modeling the semantics and the properties of the programming language and dealing with that, but on the other side, looking at the hardware. So at some point, so as we recall, please recall, when we started out as this lecture, we kind of claimed that there's an incongruence between the programming language and the hardware. And there's an intermediate language in between, and this allows kind of to buffer or to hide away some kind of difficulties. So far we have kind of tried to improve on that intermediate representation to kind of to eliminate inefficiencies introduced by the program or the programming language. Now we have this intermediate language, and now we have the hardware, and there are still incongruences. For example, in the programming language, we might use a certain amount of variables, and sometimes I call these variables also registers, because in we kind of had the intuition that we should map the variables of from the program to registers in the hardware. And so this will be our first topic. Now, what is the problem? So if clearly the names of the registers will not be X, Y, and Z, but what we observe is that while the program is allowed to use an arbitrary amount of variables, and usually the programmer is not aware on how many registers the hardware will provide him or her with. But on the other hand, yes, the hardware has a fixed number of registers, which is completely fixed. You cannot kind of change it somehow, or at least not easily, at least not on conventional hardware. So in that sense, then you must kind of make choices, so which variables to put in registers, or perhaps you have more registers than you have variables. Can you make use of them nonetheless? Things like that. So these are the problems which we might want to look at now. So here is a tiny introductory example. So here we use the variables X, and Y, and then there is this Z, and there is this TI, and then there's also this A. And now we may wonder, so we have this little program can be represented by that ridiculous small control flow graph. And so we notice the program uses a certain amount of variables, which is in this case 5. And now clearly any reasonable hardware will have more than 5 registers. But still we might consider in this little example, is it really necessary to have 5 registers in order to implement that program? So clearly we could say instead of placing each variable in a separate register, we might also decide to put several variables in the same register. So let us see why that could that be possible. Now the first thing, for example, which we notice is that as soon as we may use this T, this is towards the end of the program, then the variable X somehow is long gone. There is no X afterwards. So we might decide, so that means the X and the T kind of do not interfere. So this kind of observation, so now we may wonder, where is the X used at all? So here is an X, there's an X, there's an X, and afterwards there's no X anymore. And the T is maybe I make it in a color, the T in a different way. So here is the T. So that means these kind of, and you see kind of the argument why we think that the X and the T are would not interfere. So if they interfere, if I kind of put X and T into one register, and after the value of T has been changed, the value of X still wants to be should be retrieved, then this is not possible. So they should not, in that sense, we can only put the same variables into the same, several variables into the same registers if they do not interfere. And that means, what does it mean? It means that their life ranges somehow are disjoint. And what is the life range? This is the number of program points where the variable is life. So that is the number of program points where the value of the variable matters. Yeah? So in that sense, and then here I claim there's another variable set which can also be put into the same register. Let us see, make in green where the set is live. Okay, so set is set here at program point 7 and used at the edge until program point 8, and then at 8 it is already dead. Yeah, so it's in some sense, one can say that the set is only live at that program point. Now, X, we said, is live, is set here, so, and it is used later on here. So it is live here, it is live there, and it is live there. And afterwards it's dead. And you see, there's no program point where both X and Z is live. And now, let's see what happens about T. So T is live. No, I should put it into a different language. T in a different color. T is introduced at the edge before program point 5. It is live at program point 5 because it is used at program point at the edge from 5 to 8, and afterwards it is gone. It's no longer used. So all these, you see, there's no program point with two colors. And that's great. So in that sense, there's no interference, and we can put them all into one register. Yeah. So that is what we would like. So if we do that, then we arrive at this kind of optimization. X, Z, and T are all put into this register R. So this means I simply rename these three things into R. Okay, so that would be kind of an optimization, if you like, what we would do. This choice of putting X, Z, and T into one register was not arbitrary, but depended on these life ranges. Now, what is precisely a life range of a variable? This is the number of program points where the life range of a variable is the number of program points where this variable is life. And we could now, we have two kind of definitions of liveness, is true liveness and ordinary liveness, and we can, I simply say liveness, you could use both, but this true liveness is the better expression. Yeah, because then the true liveness ranges are smaller, so that means if the ranges are smaller, then there is a better chance that two life ranges might not overlap, and in that sense you might arrive at a better register allocation. So here is this little example. we kind of, this is now something which we kind of determine. We determine for every program point the life variables. Here in this case it doesn't make a difference whether we have liveness or true liveness. And we kind of would say now again, this it depends on what kind of context, within what kind of context we do the analysis. For example, what do we have, what happens at the endpoint? And you recall that there choices must be made. Here in this case, to keep things simple, we assume that at the program, at the exit point 8, no variable is live. But once again, if you consider, if that is the control flow graph of a procedure, then you would say that the globals, and there are globals and local variables, then the globals would all be live at program exit. And then there would not be the empty set, but everything. Okay, so it's the empty set, which is live at 8. Now, then at 7, we have liveness of A and Z, because they are both used to do this memory write. At 6, we have T and what? 6? Ah, 6 is here. 6, there is the set and is live, and the set is no longer live because it's overwritten. The set is live and the A still is live. And at program point, now proceeding to 5, proceeding to program point 5, there we see that A and T is live, because they are used in the next on the outgoing edge. At program point 4, the T is overwritten and the Y becomes live. And at program point 3 now, you have live what is either live at 4 or live at 6, and additionally Y in all cases. So therefore this means that A, X and Y are live at program point 3. At program point 2, then the Y is overwritten, so it is no longer live at 2. And at program point 1, the X is also overwritten, so it's only we have that only A is live. And at program point 0, what? There is no program point 0. I wonder what happened, has happened here. I guess one simply can cancel that out. Yeah. So this would be the situation. Now, still there is this program point 0, what we can kind of remove. Now you see, I have here marked the life ranges of T and X and Y and Z. I have not marked the life range of A, because everything A is life everywhere. Yeah, and that means that it is used in the first edge and it is used in the very last edge, so you cannot overwrite it, because you must keep it. A must be kept all the time until program point 8. Okay, so that's now we have the life ranges. We see the overlap. There's only the overlap between Y and X. So these must be kept different. These two things must be kept separate. But you also see that we could kind of put, if we have one register for Y and one for X, we could put the T into the register for the Y, or so we have several freedom how we kind of combine variables into registers. Yeah, so here are the life ranges. Okay, and now in general, so graphically we see in this little example it was easy. We just put together what were life variables with disjoint life ranges. But in general, we might have many variables and many life ranges. And the question is, how can we do it in a systematic way? And the first thing what we can do is we can have a can provide a graphical representation of what it means. And this is this interference graph. So this is all about a single. Still, this is all about a single control flow graph, and no calls for the moment. And we just want to kind of get intuition how that works, and later on we might also look at the case when we have procedures. So for this just single control flow graph, we can put up this interference graph. What is the interference graph? It consists, the nodes are the variables, and the edges kind of indicate conflicts. So this means a conflict is, we have a conflict if two variables cannot be put into the same register, for what reason soever. So here in our case, the only reason why two variables must be kept separate are when the life ranges interfere, and that means in this case. So that is kind of, this is an undirected graph. Yeah, because if X interferes with Y, then Y also interferes with X. So it's an undirected graph whose nodes are the variables of the procedure. And so in the example here, you see the interference graph. So the T and the Z all interfere with everything interferes with A, and Y interferes with X. That's the only thing what we have. Now we might want to say, we might say, okay, so this is the graph. Now what is a register allocation? A register allocation is kind of, so we can, variables can be assigned to the same register if they are not connected by an edge. And that is kind of, so this is what, so we can, such an assignment of variables or of nodes in the graph to registers, this can be considered as a, mathematically, this has been, a similar problem has been considered as graph coloring. Graph coloring is exactly the same problem. You have an undirected graph. You want to assign colors to nodes of the graph or to vertices in the graph so that whenever there's an edge between two nodes, the colors are different. And that's it. So in that sense, graph coloring is the same problem as register allocation for these interference graphs. And this observation is, so you would say, it's a trivial one. You just write down what the problem is, and then you have it. But it was in the, somehow it was, I don't know, in the old days of 62, this was innovative. Yeah, so there, computer science was in its infancy. And in that case, as you also know, the world was divided, and there was a fence, iron fence, or was it fence or is it curtain? How would one call it in English? Curtain. So there was no bad communication. The Russians didn't speak English, the Soviets didn't speak English, and the rest of the world didn't speak Russian. And so they did, and the Russians or the Soviets were not no stupid people. And so they did meaningful research, which was hidden somewhere in their own mathematical journals. And so this guy Lavrov, he considered that problem. And I think in these very old days, he considered it even more generally. He thought that he has about 1,000 memory cells, and he wants to assign the data. And that 1,000 memory cells did not correspond to a CPU with 1,000 registers, but this corresponded to the whole machine. So you have, at that time, the machines were very small, and they kind of, he thought about how can you make best utilization of this little memory which you have. And that was kind of his formulation and graph coloring. Now later, there was this Chaitin, so you see many years later, he was obviously an American, and he kind of made it popular in the West, and I think there was even a patent upon that method. So you could not freely use this trivial idea of graph coloring for doing register allocation. So that meant for a while that public domain software had to do workarounds so that it didn't look like graph coloring, but still it was graph coloring, because this is kind of the essence of the problem. So that is here once again, this is the abstract problem. So you have an undirect graph, and you are looking for a coloring of the graph, which is a mapping from the nodes to, say, numbers, if the colors are considered as a set of numbers, so that you use that for every edge, the two nodes in the edge are colored differently, and that the minimal, so if it's naturals, there's a maximal color, and so that should be minimal. So this means simply you want to use a minimal number of colors. In the example, there is perhaps one more little thing. So this, why is it called coloring in the graph theoretical world? Why should one call it? Why didn't they speak about register allocation or something else, but why graph coloring? Where did the mathematicians obtain the problem statement from? At least I find it an interesting anecdote. That problem comes from coloring maps. So, and you have these maps, so it's planar, and you have countries, and countries have borders, and as soon as they have border, they are in conflict, or at least you should not color them with the same color, so you draw an edge between these two countries. And then you get a graph, and in that sense it's even a planar graph, and then the question is, how many colors can you use to color a map? Are required to color a map, and this is the famous coloring problem for planar graphs, and it was open for a long time until they found that you can color. I think it's easy to color. What is it? Four color problem, isn't it? That my memory is so weak, but I think five colors is easy, and then it was proven in a complicated machine-assisted proof that four colors are sufficient. So this is this four-coloring problem, this four-color problem, and for planar graphs. So here we have arbitrary graphs. So this is a generalization of the problem, and you want to know how many colors are minimally required, and the result is the coloring number of the graph. And that is kind of these graph theoreticians. There, this coloring number is an important characteristic number of a graph. But then, since graphs in general are not planar, so typically four colors are not sufficient. So you need, in general, you need much more colors. The same is, you will not typically succeed to implement your program with four registers only. So in the example, because this is a very stupid example, there were only three colors which are sufficient. And then this is one thing. And then the other thing is, and that I may make black, not because it is wrong, but because it is on the negative side, these minimal colorings are not unique. And we saw it here. The example. The only thing is that Y and X should have different colors, but for T and Z we have all kinds of freedom. We could put it into the same class with Y or into the same class with X. So there are many minimal colors, colorings. Not minimal colors, but minimal colorings. And in general, that is the other, this is also on the downside. So we have this nice, if you like, reduction of this register allocation problem to the graph coloring problem. And then we can say, great, We have a reduction, we have a general problem. All these mathematicians and theoretical computer scientists have looked at graph coloring, and they certainly have come up with some brilliant algorithm. We run it and are done. But the bad news is that determining the minimal coloring and minimal coloring is one of these NP complete problems. And now that means that there are two ways out. The first thing is, okay, so then we solve an NP complete problem, and that you might say is hopeless, but at least in recent years, these NP completeness has lost quite a bit of its negative flavor, because there have been quite successful heuristics been developed to solve NP complete problems. Think of all these SAT solvers which have been created, which run perfectly fine on very large instances of hard problems. And the reason is why this SAT solver is that it uses sophisticated technology, that is on the one side, and on the other side, these NP complete problems are perhaps, does not mean that the usual instance is NP complete, but only that there are difficult instances, but they may be rare. And whether they occur in practice is a completely different story. So that means you could kind of use and put a SAT solver into your compiler and try to use that for your register location. This is not so stupid an idea, although typically they do not do it. And the reason is there is twofold, because a compiler must be really fast. And it must be fast in all circumstances. You cannot communicate to the user that he has written his program stupidly, and therefore the SAT solver takes 2 hours. Yeah, so that is not no. You must provide in a few seconds the solution. So that's it. And so that's and that is one thing. And the other thing is that simply it's not important to have the minimal coloring. This would be the minimal number of registers. It certainly only suffices to have only few registers. And if you are not completely efficient in that sense, not optimal, then this is only means that you do not exploit a certain possibility for optimization which is in the program. But it does not mean that the program fails. And that's in that sense. One can take a relaxed point of view and just rely on heuristics to do the job. Or, and that is the other thing, on special cases. And we will take a little a careful look at these special cases, because they lead then to it's no longer so novel, but leads to a current trend in compilers, namely to have a particular internal representation of programs which supports register allocation quite nicely. So let us first think about how can we do, what kind of heuristics can we use. Well, we could the most obvious heuristics which we might want to use is simply the greedy heuristics. So the greedy heuristics tries to construct a good coloring, and to make it a perfect algorithm which returns the best solution, it must kind of introduce some kind of backtracking. So you might kind of assign certain colors to variables, or certain registers to variables, and later see, I should have made a different choice. So this, if you are going for the best, you would need such kind of backtracking. And the greedy heuristic simply never backtracks. So that's it. Once you have decided for a color, for a register, then that's it. Okay, so that would be the situation with which one would implement. So one starts somewhere with the first color, and then whenever then you look at the neighbors, and then all the neighbors have colors. So when you kind of want to color a note, then you look at the neighbors which have already received colors, and if they have then you take the minimal color, which is not among the colors of your neighbors. That's it. Yeah, choose the smallest color, which is different from the colors of already colored neighbors, and that's the current color. And if a node is colored, then there is this node may have still further neighbors which have not been colored, and then proceed to one of the neighbors and color that. That's it. And then you can do this. You would do for every this kind of depth first or breadth first search, whatever you like to do here, to use here. Whenever you are done with one component, you proceed to the next component, and since the next component is completely unrelated to the first, to the other component, you can do one component after the other. So here is this kind of algorithm, kind of hacked into a pseudocode. So initially you kind of say that, well, if zero is not a color, this means that you have not yet colored every node. Then you kind of call this function color for, or this procedure color for every node. And when you call it for a node V, then this you check whether it has already a color. This means that the C of V is different from zero. Otherwise, you determine the neighbors. You determine the minimal color of the neighbors, and that is the minimal color which is different from all the colors of the neighbors. This is your current color, and then you color all the neighbors, all your neighbors. That's it. So in this sense, it's not so complicated. It's kind of the straightforward way how one might proceed. And so this is a, if you like, it is something like a pre-ordered EFS. You deal a node before you proceed. And clearly, there's no guarantee that you will come any close to the minimal coloring. But it's not so bad in practice. And so at least it provides you with some coloring. And whether it's good or bad, and it, so as it is some coloring, it, you might hope that it's good enough. And so clearly, some of these, as I said, some of it's for some time one had to be careful what to do about, but then. Because certain variants were patented and you could not kind of use it either in free software or in your favorite compiler which you want to sell. So, but that kind of has, so that you had to kind of come up with workarounds. But then that kind of the time is over because the patent has run out. And that is one thing. I think it was for 25 years and so it has run out. And the other thing is that it has been superseded by these new novel program representations, which kind of allow to do register allocation without resorting to graph coloring at all. There's one more, and one starting point, one of the first observations to improve or to replace this graph coloring thing is first to observe that the shorter the life range is, the better register allocation you can obtain. So that's kind of a trivial observation, because if the life ranges are smaller, you have more flexibility. If they are long, then the chance that they might intersect is large. But if they are small, if you split a life range into two, so this is you have already two variables, then you could kind of assign the first half of the variable corresponding to the first variable corresponding to the first half of the life range, you can put it into one register, and this is, does not, and the second half you could put into another register. You can achieve the same effect by putting them into the same register. So this means there's always, if you have a coloring for the unsplit graph, for the unsplit variables, then you can get a coloring for the split, for the program with the split variable. So in that sense, it works. But there are more colorings if you have if you do the splitting, and that means you might get colorings with fewer registers. So therefore, this life range splitting. So I illustrate that in this for basic blocks. So for basic blocks, you kind of can do it. You can consider can look at the following. So here, what happens here in the program? So what is the cause of so here you see that the X, for example, is live all the way down here for all these program points. And so since it's a long live range, it interferes. So how does it happen? So here, I stick to yellow. Here it is used to define A1. Here it is used to define another X. Here this X is used to define T. And here it is used to define Y. Here it is also used to define A2. And in the end it is used to define Y. Now what do we observe? So we observe that here, this variable, here we introduce something, somehow reuse the variable X for a different purpose, namely for X plus 1. We could rename that to X1 without changing the program. Yeah, so this means we have more variables, but there are less dependencies. And the same holds, so there's another situation where this happens, namely for the variable set. So here is the variable set, which is the value of the variable set before the block. And here we reuse this one so you redefine it. You could call it set 1. And then here you use set 1. This would kind of, having multiple definitions for the same variable, you might want to kind of make, whenever you have a definition, you make it a new variable. Yeah. So here is, according to the original life ranges, we would have that all these four variables would interfere with each other. For example, X and Y have a common program point, namely where they are live, here at the beginning. And T and Z have a common program point. Z and Y have a common program point. At the program start. So, but also T has a common program point with X, with Z, with Y. With X and with Y, so that in that sense everything interferes. So in this sense, so that is the best. So four colors, nothing can be improved on that if we take the basic block as is. But if we now introduce these split the variable X into X and X1, and likewise set into set and set 1, then we get more variables, but with less interference edges. So, for example, the X, Y, and Z now are still kind of interfere with each other due to that program point. But the X1 now only interferes with Z1 and T, for example, because of that program point. And the T only interferes with X1 and Y. here with x1 and y. And so in that sense, with x1 and y, and so we have a larger graph, but with fewer interference edges, and that means now that this graph can be colored with less colors, namely with just three colors. So now this is a little bit arty. You might say this is an artificial example, and we gain just one, we gain one register. But it's an indication that if you have a larger program or larger basic blocks, there might be more opportunities. Yeah, so that is one thing. And now there's another thing. So that is one thing. So the first thing is this life range splitting is a good idea by introducing, by making, if you like, every variable single assignment, which we can do in this basic block. And then that is one thing. And the other thing is then these life ranges on basic blocks have then another interesting property, namely that they kind of, as the basic block, so that the life range starts somewhere and ends somewhere. And so that since we have made the minimal, it is never the case that you could have that a variable is life here, then becomes dead and is life again. Yeah, that could happen if you use several, if you use a variable several times. But if you don't do that, then life ranges are intervals. They come into, there is a definition of a variable, and then later on is a use. And there's never a redefinition of that variable. And that means that there is a contiguous interval where, consisting of all the program points where this particular variable is life. And that means that then if you then draw these intervals, these life ranges, into this picture, for example, then it turns out that the interference graph is something which graph theoreticians have called an interval graph. So now what is an interval graph? It's exactly that. So you have the interval graph is the graph which you obtain if you take a line, and then you have various intervals, and the nodes are the intervals, and an edge is when intervals intersect. Now, okay, so that is, in some sense, you can say, okay, this is just the interference graph of for register allocation for basic blocks in this particular case where you have these minimal life ranges. And this is true, yes, it is the case, but, and now comes the interesting thing, that these graphs are not general graphs, but graphs of a very particular property. And this has been observed by graph theoreticians and algorithmic guys, I would say long time ago. So now what is the special property? It means, so look at that particular point, at this particular graph. Here you have three intervals which intersect. And that means that each pair of these three intervals intersects. So this means that the corresponding graph will have a clique. Yeah? And that means you have not only a clique, but you also have a point here in the interval which is common to all, so that they have a common intersection. You might say that if these intervals have a common intersection in one point, then or you might put it differently. You can put up now three numbers, not only the coloring number, but also the clique number, which is the maximal number of nodes which are mutually all interconnected. So this is a clique number. So the maximal size of a clique, and this covering number, which is here for intervals, means you have one point in an interval which is common to to how many intervals might it be an element of. And then it turns out that all these three numbers are the same. So the size of the maximal clique is the same as the minimal number of colors, is the same as this covering number. So now let me just so graph theoretically, if I have an arbitrary graph, so here is my super duper graph. So here this is hopefully a clique, and I have a few more nodes. Then clearly, in order to color the clique, you need as many colors as the clique has elements, because they are all connected, so they need all different numbers. So therefore, the clique, the size of the maximal clique is a lower bound to the number of colors. And here, it is a particular. These graphs have the particular problem, the particular property, that this lower bound is also an upper bound. So you only have to look at the maximal clique size, and that gives you the coloring number. And now you may say, oh, what have I gained by that? To determine the size of the maximal clique is also NP difficult. So I have gained nothing. But I have gained something, because these graphs have this particular other property, this other property, that it's the same as the maximal covering number. And here you see now, how can I determine the maximal covering number? Well, I go here, I start here, I find, oh, there are three intervals which I'm containing three intervals, three. Okay, two, one, one. So I can three, two, one, one, two, three, three, two, two. Yeah, I can determine each of these numbers, and I keep the maximum, and then I have the covering number. And the claim is that this is the same as the minimal number of colors and the maximal clique size. And that means I simply have a polynomial time algorithm to solve these NP complete problems for these graphs. This shows that these graphs are very special and are very simple to handle. Yeah? And so there is this, and these graph theoreticians would not have been graph theoreticians if they only looked at interval graphs. They considered that this strange property, and defined the class of graphs with this property, and called, because they are mathematicians, they like beauty, so they consider that as beauty, and therefore they call these graphs perfect. And the interesting thing is that later some people showed up and showed that these perfect graphs are really nice graphs in that sense, as they support polynomial time algorithms for interesting problems. Like, that is, if a graph is perfect, you can determine this maximal clique size generally, not only for these interval graphs, but clearly these algorithms there are more complicated. I think you can even decide in polynomial time whether a graph is perfect or not. But these are extremely complicated algorithms. So this is just a side remark, that inside this graph theory, there are non-trivial results, and quite a few non-trivial algorithms also. This is one instance of that. So for us, we notice there is this maximal coloring number, and this maximal coloring number is very good. And we like it, or at least in a compiler you would like it. Why? Because this tells you, you look at the, in this case, at the basic block, you find the coloring number is 3. What do you learn from that? You learn that 3 registers will be sufficient. Now, in this case, okay, so now think more complicated. Say you have a very complicated basic block, and you find out that this covering number is not 3, but 33. And this means that your 32 registers will not suffice. So you will have to spill one variable into memory. So you have to place it somewhere onto your stack. And that you know beforehand, not so to speak, on the fly during the graph coloring or so, but you can, you know it before finding the coloring. So you can even decide before the, you even do the actual coloring, what kind of variable you would take out. Namely, you see here, if I have only two registers, what can I do? So that means I have to remove one of those variables and one of these things to and put it into my memory, and I can make a decision because I know here it is must be one of the definitely one of these three things which I have to put into, and I would so here in this case I would perhaps decide for that one because it has the shortest life range. Things which are long have long life ranges. This means they are used for a long time, or I may kind of determine according to the frequency. But then I notice beforehand, if I remove this interval, will the coloring number, the covering number go down? So I could take that together with that. Then the covering number will go down. And then I know, okay, the result, the once I have put that particular variable into memory and not into registers, then I know my ordinary, now my register allocation will provide me with an appropriate solution to my problem. This is not the case for this other graph, for this greedy algorithms. You find out, oh, my greedy algorithm kind of goes beyond. Then you spill something, and then you find out, oh, the graph has changed now. And then the greedy algorithm will find a different coloring, and that kind of suddenly you have some spare register. So there could be strange situations there. Yeah. So now, how that is, so we saw that the number of required colors can be determined quickly because it is equal to this covering number. And this covering number can be computed by one sweep over the interval. Now the question is, we do not want to know the number of colors, we want to find the color the coloring themselves, itself. So how can we do it? Now again, so it's this is a very conceptually very easy algorithm. You iterate over the vertices in your block and maintain now, and for every whenever a new life range starts, you have to decide on the color, and whenever a variable goes out of its life range, then you may free the register which is inside, and that you simply do. That is, you maintain a list of currently free colors. If an interval starts, you allocate the next free color, and if an interval ends, you free its color. That's it, and you do no more. So it's also greedy, but the point is that now the greedy algorithm is the best one which you can do, and you have the greedy algorithm is the best one because you have a natural way how to traverse your nodes. And in general, if you don't have this interval, this underlying interval structure, you have no natural ordering. Otherwise, if you were given, I guess, the ordering, a perfect ordering to traverse your program points, your variables in the general case for the graph coloring, if then you would also be able to recover best a minimal coloring, but that you don't know how to find it, while here it is given in a natural way. So here, once again, here is for all. So initially, the set of used all registers are free, so this is the first thing, and then the initial set of and then you initialize these things init and exit for I with the empty list, and then for all intervals you kind of from U to V you mark at the program point U that there this interval I starts, and that the interval and at program point V that the interval I exits. And that's important because this interval I corresponds to a program variable. And we need to know where does its life range start and where does it end. Okay, so now I have, this is the initialization phase. Now I have recorded for every program point what starts there and what ends there. And then now I iterate over the program points. And whenever I arrive at a program point I, I check which kind of intervals start there. Then I color this interval. And I color this interval with the next free color and remove the free color from my list of free colors. And whenever I exit an interval, I put the free color, the color of that interval into the free list. And here the free list is kind of a list, but it should be clearly maintained as a priority queue. I guess that would be the best thing to do, to have always the smallest free color to use for your coloring. Yeah, if you but this priority queue thing you only need if you are not sure beforehand how many colors you need. But if you have computed the number of colors beforehand, then you can, if you know these are k, then you kind of put k colors, and then it doesn't matter which color you use, you just take any next color, and it always will be the case that your free colors will be sufficient. Yeah, so that means we could, for arbitrary programs, we might apply some heuristics for graph coloring. This is our current state of the art. And then if we did such a graph coloring, and the number of real registers is, so the graph coloring tells me I need 5 registers, then I might, but I only have 4, then I have to select certain variables, which then are spilled. Now, what is spilling? I already mentioned that, but spilling means that I kind of cannot put them on to maintain them in registers. I could apply 2 techniques to deal with that. I could kind of provide me a scratch pad of memory where I write, which is not on the stack, it's somewhere else, where I write the values of these variables into and read from there. And then the hope is that since this scratch pad is used so intensely, that it essentially always will be in the cache. And then all you replace by that accesses to registers, to accesses to caches, to cache lines, and that is typically also quite fast. So in that sense, that would be a kind of a workaround. The other way, you could also spill onto the stack. And namely, you could kind of put it in the stack. You have always for your current procedure a certain space allocated for the values of the registers, because you have to save the registers there and recover them from there after a call. And therefore, there is space there, and you could use that for storing the value of the variable. Now, clearly, it is not so. It's not completely trivial to decide which variable, if you have to spill, which variables to spill, and that is kind of big. Why? because spilled accesses to spilled variables are more expensive than accesses to registers, and variables which are used frequently should be placed in registers, and only those which are accessed irregularly or rarely, they could be taken and put to memory. So therefore one could might use what we had, this temperature, so that we certain parts in the control flow graph, we assign temperatures which are hotter than others, and variables life range interferes with such a hot area should be put into registers, and those which are not in a hot area can be easily spilled. Yeah, so that is the key idea, that you kind of try to identify in one way or other what is an inner. So here I want to have that one. What is an inner loop, and there you the registers. The variables used there should be put into memory. So that's this one. And these are internal truths which we have to take into account. This one, that for arbitrary programs we can use graph coloring, is perhaps only solution 1.0. We might hope to improve on that. We succeeded to improve on that for basic blocks. And therefore, basic blocks, the first step was this life range splitting, so that every variable is assigned to exactly once, or at most once. And there we had this nice observation that we could determine the required registers, the number of required registers beforehand. That was kind of our key insight there. And now we might wonder, and now comes the interesting question, can this idea which we have applied to to basic blocks be extended to full programs? Yeah? Can we obtain a normal form which is similar to our normal form for basic blocks, where we did this life range splitting, so that register allocation becomes cheap? And the answer is yes, but yes and no. So yes, in that there is a normal form which allows cheap register allocation. No, as this life range splitting for intervals caused the basic block to be in the single assignment form in a strict sense. So every variable is assigned to only once. Now, can that be in principle be achieved for general programs? And the answer is no, because if you have a loop and you want to increment a counter, so you will access the same x again and again and again. So it is impossible that you assign every variable only once. So in that sense, one needs some kind of weakened single assignment form, and that is this so-called static single assignment form, which is almost single assignment, and we will kind of now look at that format. And this kind of format, which we then obtain, is at the heart of a compiler framework like LLVM. This low-level virtual machine thing is based on such a static single assignment form, which is also called SSA. This is a very popular compiler framework, which is the basis of various compilers. It's only the old-fashioned GCC, which also uses SSA, but only for some kind of phases, while the LLVM uses it throughout the whole compiler. So the goal is to transform the program in such a way that every variable should be defined at most once. And we kind of make the following refinement. well, that would should only refer to life variables. If a variable is dead, it should not be assigned at all. Yeah. So that is now to be defined at most once. I said that kind of we cannot hope for, because there are loops. But we could kind of weaken this notion to say that it has one variable has only one definition. It does not mean that this definition is executed only once, because if it's in a loop, then this means that this definition is evaluated multiple times. But it has only one definition. And that would be, but even that is a little bit too weak. It could be that a variable has multiple definitions, but then at least all these multiple definitions should have a common endpoint. That is our weakening. And this kind of notion, so these things we all rule out, but we only assume that we could have multiple definitions to a variable, but they have a common endpoint. And then this is what we call here a single static assignment form. Now, how to arrive at that form? So one must say, when I define it in this way, it is a little bit, I am off. I kind of, this is not the same as what people use in virtually all of the literature, because in all of the literature, when they consider this type of low-level optimization, they use control flow graphs where the statements are the nodes and the edges are just edges. There's nothing at the edges. And that means that then they have... So what we have as labels at the edges, that is what they have in program points. And in this kind of, if you have such kind of a clumsy formalism, then they introduce particular nodes which kind of combine multiple definitions into one. And so these are these phi nodes. So this is a kind of a weird concept. We will go without these phi nodes here. But we have that there could be multiple definitions of a variable, but they have a common endpoint. So that's our point. Now, how to arrive at the SSA format? That's the big question, and there are multiple algorithms. So so then the idea is we proceed in two ways. The first is in two phases. The first phase or the first step is the following. We transform the program in such a way that each program point V is reached by at most one definition. So one definition, and here a definition I say is the endpoint of variables, assignments to that variable. Yeah? So every program point V is reached by at most one definition of a variable, which is life at this program point. So, and that if we have once we have that, then we kind of introduce a separate variable X for every occurrence of a definition of X. So whenever we have a definition of X at a program point V, then, and this is the first definition textually in our program, then we kind of say this is the X1. And if the next definition of X is at some other program point, then this is X2. And then since every program point is reached by only one definition, then this definition was then not X, but X we have renamed to X1. So since a use of this variable, if there arrives only this the definition which we called X1, then we rename there the use of X into the use of X1. So that's kind of the idea. Now let's see how we implement that that step. And for that, we kind of determine for every program point the set of reaching definitions. So that's kind of the idea, the first step. And there is kind of so he, maybe here you let us see how this would work. So here we have the reaching definitions. So what is an endpoint of a definition? So the first thing is that at program point zero is considered as a definition of every variable. So therefore, we would call it, so x is defined there and y is defined there. Then program point one is reached by a definition of x, and also the definition of program point one is a definition of x, and it is therefore this definition the x comma one also reaches this program point, and also the definition of y at program point zero reaches this program point. So therefore at program point one we have x comma one and y comma zero. At program point two there's a new definition of y, so therefore there we have the x comma one and the y comma two. And also here this program point five is also a definition of x, and the program point four is a definition of y. These also reach program point two, giving us altogether then in the end these four definitions which reach program point two. At program point three there is from two to three there is no definition, so therefore all the same definitions reach program point three. For program point four there is a redefinition of y, so therefore the definitions of x still arrive at program point four, but the program point but variable from the definitions of the variable y only the latest one arrives, so there we have only one. Now at program point five the same happens to the x's. From the two definitions only the last one will arrive. At program point six now this is the other reached by the other outgoing edge of program point two. There we have everything which reaches program point two also reaches program point six, and at program point seven the same because no variable is redefined. So here in that case, in this situation, I am sorry, I kind of spared you the round robin iteration to determine the reaching definitions. But you see, you also see the following, that at certain program points, like program point two, two definitions of x arrive, and at program point, and two definitions of y arrive. And the same holds true for virtually every program point, that several multiple definitions of the same variable arrive. So it does not. The goal of the first phase is not yet reached, because the goal was that every program point is reached only by a single definition. Yeah. So then there was, here is this extra assumption that all incoming edges of a join node are labeled with the same parallel assignment x equals x. So that is kind of the trick which we will play. So if we kind of have a join point, then we can kind of if we assume that the ingoing edges are labeled with knob, which is not the case here in this program. So here this edge is labeled with knob. But here we should kind of introduce an extra node, which then goes to the two, so that the two ingoing edges to two are labeled with with Nob. So then, if we kind of now a reaching definition of X could arrive from the left or the right ingoing edge. Now, if I place at these two edges the assignment X equals X, then X becomes a single definition, and it kind of hides away all other definitions. So that is the play we would trick. So here you see, we kind of would place here at this joint point we could place there assignments to X and to Y, these stupid assignments which do not change the semantics. But if we do that, then program point 2 suddenly only receives so program point 2 becomes a definition of X and a definition of Y, and that means that this kind of goes away. This goes away, and instead we have now X 2 and Y 2 at that program point. Yeah? And that would mean that also program point 3 is only reached by the definition at program point 2, by the definitions of program point 2, and so on. So, but in that case, this would kind of solve the problem and transform the control flow graph in such a way that every program point is only reached by a single definition. You see the trick? Now, please note that this assignment here is a very specific assignment in that, so I have drawn here a vertical bar. And the vertical bar means that this kind of assignment from X to X and from Y to Y is a parallel assignment. So there's no, you kind of must think of it that the predecessor values should be evaluated first and then assigned to the successor variables. And the reason is that later the same variable could occur on the left and on the right. And then you have to know what the semantics of that should be. So here in that case is X to X and Y to Y. This doesn't matter in which order you evaluate these. But if later on this statement will be transformed further, and then it will matter. So for the moment, it is so whether we have a parallel assignment or a sequential would not make a difference, but in later it will. Okay, so that was kind of the trick which we would like to play. Now, before we play that trick, let us kind of nail down how this region definition analysis looks like. So the lattice for reaching definitions is sets of definitions, and the definition is a variable together with the endpoint of a definition. And the definitions of X are those possible nodes where X is defined. So it takes the form of a pair of X and some program point. Now then, how does the analysis work? What are the transformations induced by the control flow edges? So if we have a definition of X, and R could be not only could be memory read, but it could also be ordinary assignment. Well, then V is a definition of X. So that means that X comma V is added to the set R, but it hides all former definitions of X. So therefore, we have to remove all the definitions which have been there in R before. And the same is what happens if you have already a program with such parallel assignments, then these are definitions of all such an edge is a definition of all the variables in this set L, and therefore all the definitions which have before been in the set R are removed, and instead we add this single x, r, the definitions x, v for x in L. Okay, so that's all, and the other edges would not change this, the sets of reaching definitions. And at program point start, we would say, yes, at program point start, every variable is, the program point start is a definition of every variable, because we assume that every variable has a value at program start. And that must come somewhere. So that is, therefore, the program start is a definition of every variable. Okay? And now, what is the transformation? What we do? Now, whenever, now we have assumed that for every program point, we have at hand the set of reaching definitions. What we then do is the following. Whenever we have several ingoing edges, we have multiple ingoing edges, so we have a join point, this is this V, then we kind of add extra, then we introduce these phi, these parallel assignments, x equals x, and namely in such a way that whenever we have a variable which is live at program point V, but where multiple definitions arrive. Yeah, if we look at the reaching definitions at V, and there are more than one definition, then we kind of introduce these phi nodes. As it's not phi nodes, but these kind of extra splitting of the ingoing edges and these phi assignments, psi assignments, these parallel assignments of all these nodes. This means that after this transformations, that all ingoing, all the program point V is only reached by a single definition and no longer by multiple definitions. And now it could also be that the start node has incoming edges, and then we would kind of also introduce a psi here, and that would be that would mean that for every variable which is live at the start point, which has more than one definitions, reaching definitions, we would create this parallel. We would include that variable into the parallel assignment. So now, what is what have we gained by that? So by that we have. So the first thing is, so at program start is interpreted as a definition of every variable, and at some edges we would introduce these parallel assignments x equals x, which do not change the semantics, but change or collapse, if you like, or introduce new definitions and hide away multiple definitions. So now, then the point is that that is a useful thing, and it will kind of serve the purpose, but it will not, in some sense, not be minimal, because we would perhaps introduce too many definitions. That means, as, so by that, in this one single go, we would immediately arrive at a single assignment form, because after this transformation, at every join point, we have a single reaching definition, and whenever we have no join point, then this means there's only one predecessor, and then the single definition is propagated. So this transformation does the job, and it's very fast and very very efficient, but it might not, it might introduce useless assignments x to x. And that is kind of bad, because x to x is again a register move, and it costs. So we kind of have gained a simpler format of the for the program, namely this static single assignment form, but at the price that we introduced unnecessary variable, variable assignments, or later register, register moves. So therefore one might want to improve on that and be a little bit less aggressive with the introduction of these into auxiliary assignments x equals x. And so we do it in such a way, because it could be that a set you have a join point and multiple definitions of x arrive at the join point. But it could be that if I insert at another join point, which has happened before, these kind of x equals x assignments, that there the multiple definitions of the x have already been merged into one. And after having processed that node, the later node would not need any such kind of assignments anymore. So that is, and therefore we might use the following heuristics. Only if I have several ingoing edges, and if the sets of reaching definitions along these edges differ, only then I would insert these x equals x assignments on these two edges. So what means? So I have an edge incoming edge from here and an incoming edge from there, and here I have x comma 1 and x comma 2, and here I have only x comma 1. Now clearly these two sets differ, and therefore I have to insert an assignment. So that I have to an assignment x equals x at this edge. Now if it happened that from these two sides here comes x equals 1 and x equals 2, and here comes the same set, then my hypothesis is that there has been some earlier node where these two, where x1 and x2 have arrived. And at that earlier node, I would place this x equals x assignments to join together these two definitions into one. And after I would have done that, at this particular program point, I would not have to do any joins anymore. Yeah? So that is, in this sense, we kind of now proceed as follows. Whenever we see a program point V where the sets of reaching definitions along the two edges differ, then we introduce this assignment x equals x, and this is kind of repeated until every V is reached by exactly one definition for a variable. So we cannot then, this we would no longer succeed to do this insertion of parallel assignments x equals x once, but we have to do it repeatedly. And now the point is that this repetition terminates very quickly. And so in that sense, we have to repeatedly do this reaching definitions analysis and this insertion of parallel edges. And with every insertion, we remove some of the multiple definitions of a variable, and in the end, we have removed all of them. So, but that... how that works precisely, we will look at in the next lecture, and that next lecture will be next year. So I wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, and we meet again in January. Thank you.